The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 5th of August 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's program.
We need an urgent reversal from the majority of vaccines going to high-income countries to the majority going to low-income countries.
The WHO calls for a moratorium on COVID vaccine boosters, but will wealthy nations cooperate? Also ahead, Iran's new leader, Ebrahim Raisi, is sworn in today. We'll be unpacking the many challenges facing the country's eighth president. Plus, Bloomberg's Ewan Potts will have the day's business news. And later on the program, Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here with this week's Global Countdown. Where are we heading this week, Faye?
Kamusta, Chris. Today I'm heading to a country that is home to P-pop, a potential competitor to K-pop.
Hip-hop. That will be interesting to hear. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. Now, it's a simple question of priorities. The World Health Organization has called on wealthy nations to hold off on giving booster vaccine shots to their populations for at least 2 months, and focus instead on getting more vaccines to developing countries first. The call comes as a number of countries, including France, Germany, and Israel, have announced plans to offer a third vaccine shot to the elderly and more vulnerable, citing the new variants of COVID as one reason to push forward. So who is right on this? And or as the US has said, is this a false choice and we can do both? For more on this, I'm joined by Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. And also on the line with us from Baltimore is Dr. Gigi Granvall, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Thank you both for joining us today. Gigi, let me start with you. The data, I mean, would seem to be with the WHO in the sense that, you know, we've seen huge inequities in the dissemination of vaccines worldwide so far. Is there logic behind the WHO's call for a moratorium on booster shots?
You're right that there is a huge inequity that needs to be addressed. And there are vaccines that are going from the U.S. to many other countries now that supplies have been turned on and are at a high level and demand is slacked off here in the U.S. But it's a little bit like the notion of, you know, well, what if we cut this defense program, then we'll be able to fund all these other things that education. And it's like, it just doesn't work that way. And I think it's not only a false choice, it's just not going to happen.
Well, on that, maybe is it your feeling then that the problem that we're seeing in developing nations, you know, for example, Africa, only about 2% of the population have gotten vaccines. Is that then more a problem about, you know, dissemination, getting vaccines to these countries? Or is it that wealthy nations are to some degree hoarding vaccines and having a more direct impact?
It is a combination for sure. And it's also just the total need that we're talking about here. We need to vaccinate the entire world. And so that's a lot of people, not a lot of vaccine. And so, this is just the situation we have now. I'm very sympathetic to the call. But I think that in the U.S., it is likely that at some point boosters will be given to people who have some immune problems, people who have had liver transplants, people with other conditions, people who are very, very elderly and might need a little extra boost or on immune suppressing medications. So I think it's going to be very hard to say that these people cannot get a booster. I think it's more a matter of we need to supply the rest of the world and boost that. And I think that's going to be the path forward.
Well, Chris, let me bring you in on that. I mean, what does the data say about the necessity of extra booster shots, particularly, as Gigi mentioned there, for the vulnerable? I mean, the WHO has suggested that it's not even clear that booster shots are necessary. What's your take?
What we've learned so far across the pandemic about immunity to coronaviruses suggests that over time, immunity does wane, whether or not you've caught the infection or you've been vaccinated. And so many countries which prioritised the vaccination in the first instance of those people judged to be most clinically vulnerable to infection, which generally means the elderly, it means that those people have had a big time elapsed between when they were vaccinated and the forthcoming winter in the Northern Hemisphere. And we know that winter always poses a very big challenge on many levels. And so we have this potentially threatening combination of a long time elapsed, waning immunity and a resurgence of a virus in the autumn confronting the elderly or the other vulnerable people. And given that we know that boosting does raise antibody levels, and given that we also know that your level of protection is directly proportional to how many antibodies you have, it makes sense to offer people who are most vulnerable a booster, because that will restore or at least maintain their level of protection. And there is a significant risk that if the protection it wanes because of time ticking, which it does, those people would become vulnerable again. And that could potentially unpick all the good work that's been done in many countries, getting those people vaccinated in the first place. So we're really between a rock and a hard place. This is a political hot potato, isn't it? Where you've got countries saying, well, we want to do the right thing, but who do we want to do the right thing by? Do we want to do the right thing by our own population that we've already gone to enormous cost to try to protect? Or do we want to potentially throw out that good work and protect someone else's population, because that's fair? It's unfair whichever way you look at it, unfortunately.
Well, just on, to stay with you on that, Chris, I mean, this isn't, though, necessarily just about booster shots. The UK, for example, is also looking to expand vaccinations to include teenagers. What are your thoughts on that? How essential is that step, with adults already vaccinated?
Well, the UK strategy already includes teenagers over the age of 18, and recent legislation included rolling out vaccines to people 16 and 17. And I think that's with good reason. The reason being that if you look at who is accounting for the cases we have in the country, there is a very significant proportion of people under the age of 30. In fact, it's one in three people under 30 who are not vaccinated. And that's 3 million people. And where are all the infections happening among the unvaccinated, with a very big spike among the young? So intervening among the young does actually help to protect the old, because you haven't got a conduit through society for the infection to spread in an unmitigated way. So it does make sense to vaccinate everybody, actually, regardless of age, because that's how you gain control. That's how you keep the effective virological firebreak in place that helps to retard the spread of the infection through the population.
Gigi, just can I add to that, one of the things that's happening in the U.S. is there's an increased, increasing mandates for vaccination, which is also going to help protect the very elderly if, their healthcare workers are vaccinated. But to add to, right now here, you can get, in the U.S., you can get vaccinated if you're 12 and up. I think, now that there are increasing numbers of pediatric hospitalizations, we will see, more demand for even younger vaccinations than that, because we don't know what the long-term effects of this disease may be, and so we do have something that that may be of benefit.
Well, and Gigi, just to bring up one other point with you, there is a lot of also misinformation, of course, in general out there in the U.S. And one particular aspect that you've been looking at is regarding vaccines and pregnant women. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. The all societies and reputable doctors are pushing are encouraging pregnant people to get vaccinated. It's really important when you're pregnant. I know everybody is very has a lot of heightened concerns about what they put into their bodies and what they do. But pregnant women are more than twice as likely to end up in the hospital with COVID. They have a lot more severe outcomes, and it is such a safer thing for people to do to protect themselves and their child to get vaccinated. And there's no, there are thousands of people who have, and thousands of people who have gotten the vaccine and gone on to get pregnant. So there's no effect on fertility. It really is just something that you can do to protect you and your baby. And so that is something that that I'm trying to encourage. I myself was pregnant during the 2009 H1N1 outbreak, which had many very severe outcomes for pregnant women. And we were just waiting for a vaccine. But even then, I knew friends of mine that refused to take the vaccine because they worried that it could have some negative effect. And don't do that. A lot of these people ended up in the hospital. It's not a good plan.
Thank you very much for that, Gigi and Chris. We would certainly recommend everybody get the vaccine where it is available. That was Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith, and Dr. Gigi Granville of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Now here's Monocle's Carlotta Ribello with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Chris. The United States has hit a six-month high for new COVID-19 cases. Yesterday, over 100,000 infections were reported as the Delta variant ravages areas where people have not been vaccinated. Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Biden's key advisor, has warned that new cases could double up to 200,000 per day in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, the United Kingdom has eased travel restrictions on people arriving from France who no longer need to quarantine for up to 10 days. The UK has also added six European countries to its green list, including Germany, meaning there is no need to quarantine even for those who are not fully vaccinated. The Mexican government has sued U.S. gun manufacturers and distributors, arguing that their negligent and illegal commercial practices have fueled bloodshed in Mexico. The lawsuit alleges that the companies knew they were contributing to illegal arms trafficking, which has been linked to a number of deaths. It is one of the boldest steps ever taken by Mexico to pressure the U.S. arms industry, which Mexican leaders have for years blamed for the violence. And today's Monocle Minute reports on a plan by the Japanese government to shift to renewable energy-powered vehicles across all national agencies from April 2022. You can read more at monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Carlotta. Now to Iran, where talks between Washington and Tehran on the on-again, off-again nuclear deal are about to get a lot tougher. Ebrahim Raisi is set to be sworn in by parliament today as Iran's next president. Now, Raisi is known as a conservative hardliner, allied with Iran's supreme leader. He's vowed to ease economic pressures on ordinary Iranians and play hardball with the United States and foreign powers. Earlier, I spoke to Vali Nasser. He's a former U.S. State Department advisor and currently professor of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And I spoke to him about what we can expect from Iran's new leadership, started by asking him about the new president and how he differs from his more moderate predecessor, Hassan Rouhani.
Mr. Raisi is a cleric by education. He has had his entire career in the judiciary in Iran from young age until he became the chief of Iran's judiciary. And in that sense, he's a legal bureaucrat. His political views are very hardline. He would be part of the right side of Iran's conservative faction in Iran's politics. On domestic issues, he supports the cultural restrictions, political restrictions that have been the hallmark of the conservatives. But he has had very little foreign policy experience, and he has had very little management or government experience. So in that sense, he's a bit of a black box. He has not spent time running many large government agencies or ministries in Iran. nor has he been involved in foreign policy decision making. So in a way, he's a novice in that regard, which is very different from his predecessor, who came to power not only being much more moderate, but also being very well seasoned as a national security person and someone with experience in management.
So different from his predecessor and perhaps also a little bit unpredictable in that regard. I mean, it's also always, of course, interesting to look at the role of the president as well, you know, compared to Iran's supreme leader. It sounds like you're saying he's in a way more politically aligned with the supreme leader. How much do you expect him to differ, perhaps, or take on, you know, where might we see the two of them differ and have a different line?
The relationships between the supreme leader and the president have always had a certain degree of tension, not for political reasons per se, but for reasons of turf and where does the authority of one stop and the authority of the other one start. And in fact, ironically, the supreme leader had the most difficult time with the conservative populist Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who openly challenged the supreme leader's authority on a variety of administrative and political issues. I don't think Mr. Raisi would do that. He's very much been elevated to his position by the supreme leader, and at least it would take him 1 or 2 years before he finds his feet in his job in order to be able to assert himself. But something else that's happened, which is that his election and the consolidation of power in the presidency, in the judiciary, and in the parliament by the conservatives has not brought about the internal rifts and competitions between the conservatives themselves. So there will be other conservatives close to the supreme leader who are likely to disagree with Mr. Raisi on domestic issues, foreign policy issues, or simply see him as a competition as they prepare themselves for the succession to the supreme leader. And on management issues, many people think that given that Mr. Raisi does not have much experience, that the supreme leader through various ministers and the parliament may play a more important role in the executive functions of the country as well.
Mr. Raisi has so far also talked about, a couple of days ago, he gave a speech talking about how he wants to lift up Iran's economy. And I suppose to some of your points there, the two are inevitably linked with Iran. Raisi spoke about ending the sort of tyrannical sanctions, as he called them, by the U.S., and also sort of ending the sort of foreign powers, effect on the Iranian economy. He needs the U.S. as well to do that, of course, doesn't he? So what about his views on the U.S. and the Iran nuclear deal?
I think unlike his predecessor, he doesn't want normalization with the U.S. or too much opening with the U.S., but he does want a nuclear deal that would lift sanctions on Iran. I think you're correct. He's very motivated with consolidating his own position as a politician and consolidating the wins that the conservatives have had by improving the daily economic lives in the country. And in fact, since he was elected, things have got worse. There's a fifth wave of COVID with the Delta variant. There have been water shortages and riots in Iran's oil province. There have been debilitating electricity shortages. The people are under a lot of economic pressure, and that creates political tensions. But at the same time, I think he's going to be more difficult for the United States to deal with. The fact that he wants a deal in principle does not mean that he will agree to the same terms that Mr. Rouhani was willing to agree to. So the good news is that he wants a deal, and if there's a deal with him as a conservative, he's not going to be criticized for signing that deal domestically. The bad news is that he's both a novice in foreign policy, but also he's going to ask for more concessions from the United States than his predecessor.
Well, and finally, as you say, a novice in foreign policy, what about the regional role and influence of Iran? This is something obviously focused a lot on internationally, also because of the tanker incidents this week. What do you expect from him there? Or will he focus more on the domestic issues, as you speak of, rather than pushing Iran's regional role?
I don't think there's going to be much difference there. I think Iran's regional role in the way in which Iran sees its influence in Iraq or Lebanon and the way in which it uses events like tanker attacks, attacks in Iraq as leverage against its neighbors and the United States are much more embedded in Iran's strategic thinking that is dominated by Iran's security sector, IRGC, military and security people who are close to the supreme leader. So that's not going to change. Those people have been in charge so far. But the difference with Mr. Rouhani's period is that there were some seasoned diplomats who sat around the national security table who were able to argue for caution or argue for other policies and have an influence. Now, those people are not going to be around the table, somebody like Iran's foreign minister Zarif or somebody like Mr. Rouhani himself, who had better understanding of an international scene, are not going to be around the table. So I think it's not so much Mr. Raisi himself, it's that the composition of Iran's foreign policy decision making is going to lean in the direction of hardline policies much more.
That was Vali Nasser from Johns Hopkins University. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. We'll be right back after this.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that's committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, we're exploring global drug development and hearing from those that lead Novartis's effort in clinical trials. Lani Hashimoto works for the U.S. Trial Monitoring Organization to help operationalize patient and site engagement. Lani was part of a non-Novartis COVID trial. Lani Hashimoto, perhaps you can tell us about the path that brought you here.
I always wanted to make a difference, and I thought that that answer was teaching, was public education. And so all of my preparatory work was to be a teacher, and found myself still wanting to make a difference, wanting to innovate, and having found myself here in the drug development industry now for 20-something years, this is really the perfect solution for me to be a part of learning and innovation and teaching. And it really satisfies the lifelong learner in me to work with so many different clinical trial teams across all of our different indications. And so drug development for many, many years was then the impetus to walk the walk. If you want to represent and talk for patients, it became important to me many years ago to be a patient in a clinical research program. And that's one of the things that brings me to today's conversation.
Lani Hashimoto, who works with the U.S. Trial Monitoring Organization to help operationalize patient and site engagement. An enduring commitment for more than a quarter of a century. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now it's time for a look through some of the day's main business stories with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, we had in the Monocle Minute today a story from Japan about electric vehicles. You have something from the US also moving ahead with an ambitious target for electric car sales.
Chris, yeah, President Joe Biden is to call for half of all vehicles sold in the US to be capable of emissions-free driving by the end of the decade. So in less than 8.5 years' time, in the world's second biggest car market, half of cars sold should be battery electric, plug-in hybrid, or fuel cell powered. It is a pretty bold target. It's part of the president's Build Back Better agenda, which he says will strengthen American leadership in clean cars and trucks by accelerating innovation and manufacturing. Now, the mandates are a centerpiece of Biden's climate plans. It's really the administration's first major use of regulation to attempt to stem greenhouse gases. We're also expecting to hear more on additional rules to target methane emissions from oil wells and carbon dioxide releases from power plants. Remember that the Trump administration relaxed requirements on many of these things. So we're seeing a rowing back of these from the new Democratic president, or fairly new president. It's a pretty tough target, though. Government data in the US suggests that there are only about 40,000 charging stations. That is not many for a big country, and electric vehicles last year represented just 2% of car sales in the US.
It is interesting, Ewan, to hear and see how many governments are sort of unveiling these very ambitious targets when it comes to electric vehicles. But staying for a second question with you on autos, another warning on the chip shortage.
Yeah, we heard last month from US Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo. She said that things are getting better for car makers suffering these big chip shortages. Well, it turns out things are not really getting that much better. We've heard from two of the world's biggest makers of chips used by car makers, Infineon Technologies and NXP Semiconductors. And they say that the problem is far from over. And the pivot to electric vehicles we've just been talking about is going to make it worse. Now, these chip makers say that they've been ramping up supply, but demand is still outstripping that supply. And this problem is going to go on to well into 2022. Now, if you think this is a minor problem, chips can't be that important for making cars, surely it's all about the steel and the plastics, etc. Well, no, electronics are absolutely vital to modern cars. And so far, the lack of chips, this chip shortage has cost car makers around the world at least $110 billion in lost sales. A lot of auto dealerships left with empty lots, preventing car manufacturers from fully capitalizing on a post-COVID surge in demand. And I'll just leave you with one fascinating stat. Fully 40% of the cost of a new car now goes into electronics.
That is quite a stat. Chips are really so crucial for so many things that we use that we don't realize. Ewan, thank you very much for that. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. All right, and finally on today's program, we're joined by Monocle's senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, for this week's Pop Extravaganza. Faye, I know that you wanted to do Austria in my sort of honor, but we didn't quite find enough of interest there. So where are we heading instead?
I promise you that Austria is coming sometime soon, but today I decided to head to the Philippines. I wanted to do a country that had a nice story as well, the Olympics. Can you believe, Chris, that they had their first gold medal in 100 years? So they had to wait a century to get another one. But thankfully they did on weightlifting.
100 years is an amazing amount of time to wait, but it's a good thing to honor. So what do we have?
I promise you there are more Filipino acts here. But at number five, as everywhere in the world, they love Maneskin. We have a play a clip once again of their version of Begging. Let's have a listen. Yeah, anytime I feel you get me, no. Anytime I see you let me know. But the plan and see, just let me go. I'm on my knees when I'm begging, cause I don't wanna lose you. Hey, yeah, ra-da-da-da, cause I'm begging you, put your love in the hand now, baby. We have heard this song before on the Global Countdown. So many times.
It's just amazing how far Maneskin has made it, that they go all the way to number five in the Philippine charts.
They are going everywhere. They're doing so well. And Chris, I have a little trivia for you. They're releasing a song with Iggy Pop tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
So if you're a fan of Iggy Pop and Maneskin together, do go and have a listen to the track.
Well, we'll keep an eye out for that one.
Chris, let's go for number four here. It's a Filipino act now. It's called Ben and Ben. They are kind of a folk pop group. And it's called Ben and Ben because both of the lead vocals, they're called, they have Benjamin in their names. So they used to be called actually the Benjamins. But now it's just a Ben and Ben. And I think
Ben and Ben makes a little more sense than the Benjamins. I'm going to give them that.
Easier, a bit easier, right? And then the song's called Pasalubong. It's just a beautiful ballad. If you translate that, that's Filipino for souvenir. And it's very earnest, a beautiful ballad there. Let's have a listen to number four. Maghihintay ako hanggang mapasayo pa sa lubong naman sa aking nararamdaman. That is a very soft sounding, quite nice ballad style there. I'll give them that. If you like soft soundings, you will like this chart. I mean, as I said, quite earnest. Number 3, 211 have that in common. Beautiful themes, actually, almost emotional. And number 3 is a very interesting story, Chris. He's not actually from the Philippines. He grew up in the UK, Singapore, and India as well. His name is Dhruv. And he's a queer guy. That's how he recognizes himself. So it's quite interesting because some of those countries can still be very conservative. But he's doing so well. And now he became a TikTok star, of course.
Who is not a TikTok star?
Exactly.
Yes, whichever country you look at.
Exactly. I want to become a TikTok star as well. Let's have a listen. Another very soft sounding, as you've said about Ben and Ben before. This is Dhruv
with Double Take. In my rose-tinted dreams, wrinkled silk on my sheets, I don't see nobody but you. Boy, you got me hooked up to something. Who could say that they saw us? Come and tell me, do you feel the love? Spend the summer of a lifetime with me. Let me take you to the place where your dreams tell me, do you feel the love?
Soft sounding, but a little bit different, more of a beat to that one.
Exactly.
I like that as well.
And can you believe it's from 2019, but it's been a big trend in the music industry that songs are kind of rediscovered as well. So sometimes you get a track, you know, from years ago and suddenly it's back in the charts. Even though he's quite a young guy, he has new singles out, but this Double Take doing very well, not only in the Philippines, but all across Southeast Asia.
That's interesting, as you say, even with Maneskin as well, always these bands that suddenly are coming back into focus and we're hearing old songs from them in the charts.
Absolutely. And Chris, I mentioned to you P-pop, right? Which is kind of this form of Filipino pop music. And to be honest, I think, you know, K-pop should be very careful, because I think P-pop will do very well in the coming years, I would say.
An actual international export, not just the Philippine charts. That's your prediction.
That's my prediction. And I think this next band that we're going to hear, SB19, they could be part of that movement. The song's called MAPA, which it's maps, right? And it's quite an emotional track. They started doing very kind of up-tempo pop, but this one is a special song to a tribute to their parents. Let's have a listen. Kaya huwag mag-alala, ipikit ang iyong mata, tana. Pahinga muna, ako nang bahala. Labis pa sa labis ang iyong nagawa. Very, very poppy, I feel, on that one. Sort of, we're moving back into the sort of pop music, soft but pop music style. Very cute. I mean, the track says, Mom, how are you? We haven't seen each other anymore. I miss you so much. It's quite beautiful, actually.
Well, especially after the year we've had, I think we can all relate to that one particularly well. So it's
exactly. Nice
to have an ode to Mom.
I love some earnest pop sometimes. And number one, it's also very earnest. And it's interesting because he's a Filipino rapper. I mean, he looks very tattooed, you know, kind of, he looks like a cool guy. But this song, he had a baby very recently. This song's all about fatherhood. So if you see the video, he's, you know.
From motherhood to fatherhood.
That's a good kind of, he says, looking at you isn't tiring to his baby. Very sweet. I like that a man is expressing those emotions so openly as well. Let's have a listen. It's the Filipino rapper Skista Klee with Lagi. Okay lang, nandito lang ako na laging nakaabang kahit na magdamago. Eh ano naman kung ilang oras ang masayang, di naman ako manghihinayang, handa kong magbabad makasama ka lang. Ayos lang kahit gabihin.
I think I do have a sense now, Faye, of what kind of music the Philippines likes. They're all this very soothing, soft sound, but nice.
And family-oriented as well, right? I thought it was so cool. And, you know, he's so happy that he's got his new baby as well.
Yes, I mean, this fatherhood is a very nice theme to go on for this as well.
Very earnest. Sometimes we do need that earnest pop here on the Global Countdown.
Earnest pop.
Yes.
That's it for us today. Thanks very much, Faye. That was Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that is all we have time for on this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Emma Searle and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our studio manager today was Louis Allen. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.